Welcome to the NOLA Drink Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink, food, and culture in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, thanks for listening into the show this week. Brian Diaz here with you on the NOLA Drink Show. Yep, got a really good show coming up for you here today, and I'll run that down for you in just a second. Wanted to make a quick note, of course, of the tragedy that occurred Saturday here in New Orleans over the weekend. I'm sure if you're listening outside the area, it was also national news, so you're probably aware that the construction site for the new Hard Rock Hotel on the edge of the French Quarter there at Canal Street, right by the Sanger Theater, the construction site collapsed. Numerous people were injured, at least at the time of recording this, which is midday or so on Monday. Two known fatalities, one person still missing. There is still a search and rescue operation at this time going on. And we just want to send our thoughts and best wishes and condolences where necessary to all those affected by this tragedy. It is hard not to think, at least for me, hard not to think about how bad this could have been, and not to say little solace, of course, for those who were affected. So don't mean to be insensitive there, but fortunately, this did not occur on a weekday because of the increased automobile traffic there on Canal Street, as well as the increased pedestrian traffic that would have been present. Even still, that it took place on Saturday, it could have been a lot worse. It's really almost a miracle that more people were not injured or killed. But again, little solace to those who are affected by this, and our thoughts are with them. Did also want to note the Hard Rock International Corporation put out a statement not too long after the accident occurred, and I was mildly put off. It's probably a good way to put it by their statement, because of the first part of the statement, they basically threw their contractor and builder under the bus, said this is a licensing agreement. We have nothing to do with the construction. Oh, and sort of, if you will, by the way, our thoughts are with the victims. And that was kind of how it read to me. Now, this all may be true. Probably is true that this is a license agreement. We know that part is true. And that they had nothing to do with the construction. But to me, in the wake of something like this occurring, that's not how you handle this. You show some more sympathy and you step up to be a player in the situation and lending and giving more support. You're building a large hotel here in New Orleans. You want to be part of the community. You've had other business operations here. Be a part of the community and step up and be an entity that wants to show support and compassion for the situation, as opposed to just immediately distancing yourself from it. We'll see where all this leads as far as ramifications from this accident. Of course, the area is still closed in a fairly sizable radius. It's going to mess up traffic, as we know, for quite some time. Please avoid the area. Let those that are working there to stabilize the building and those that are still searching for, unfortunately, the one missing person at the time that we were recording this. This is now noon on Monday. Let them do their work. There's really nothing to see there at this point, so that can get done and we can try and return to some sense of normalcy after this terrible tragedy. Friends, did mention a really good show for you here this week. We are talking with independent journalist, freelance writer, Boyce Upholt. And Boyce is a fairly new, been here a little bit over a year, about a year, 3 months, I believe, here in New Orleans. Writes for The Atlantic, writes for Medium, several other outlets. Very interesting guy. He recently did a piece that appeared in Heated, which is part of the Medium network there, talking about the economy of food halls. It's a very interesting subject, and one of the featured food halls that he discusses is the St. Rock Marketplace, sort of the first one that set off the trend here in New Orleans. And of course, this is going on all over the country, and there's a lot of stuff that you might want to hear. It's not all Skittles and beer in the world of food halls, how it works for those that are tenants, and even how it works for the neighborhoods who get them, especially in the case of St. Rock. It's been beset by a certain amount of controversy due to the ownership, what they promised, what was delivered, the city, how they're handling it, perhaps, and several other factors. Now, we don't talk about, it's not all negative. We talk about some of the positive things that have gone on at St. Rock, as well as other food halls. But talking about how some of the structure of the economy works, the leases work for vendors, these sorts of things. It's a fascinating, fascinating conversation, especially, again, as we see so many food halls popping up around the country. And I think we're on about four or five here in New Orleans at this point. I think it's something that you want to hear to just sort of learn how these things go down. And if you're somebody that maybe is thinking about operating in a food hall, you might want to pay attention to this show as well, because it's, again, not all Skittles and beer. Might be a little bit more financially difficult than you think, and a lot more work than you think. So that's our featured interview. Special thanks to our friends at Two Jags who hosted us for that interview. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to take a little break here, friends, on the show. Then we're going to bounce over to Two Jags and talk to Boyce Upholt about the economy of food halls. Come on back.
Well, after I'm through, this mighty cootie fire on a mighty broad day.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for listening in, friends, this week as always. And yes, as you know, we are here with our featured interview at Two Jags Restaurant. Thanks to these guys for hosting us, as they so frequently do, as recently as last week, really. And we're chatting with our guest, Boyce Upholt. And Boyce is a freelance writer and journalist and fairly new to the New Orleans area, but does a lot of stuff on food and drink and things like that, and some other interesting pieces. And Boyce, welcome to the show, man.
Thank you. So glad to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I was going to tell you before we went on the air, I think I'm a little slow on the uptake because I was kind of piecing together somebody. You've been here about a year and a half, you said, right?
A year and a quarter. Yeah.
Somebody told me, I'm trying to remember who it was. Somebody told me about you when you moved to town and said, this is somebody that you should know.
Wow.
And I after you and I had some communication via email, and you said something to the effect that, you know, you're going to start doing some writing on cocktails, which we'll get to in a bit. And you said, you're somebody that I should probably know. So now, right. Now we know each other.
That's great. I felt like I was nobody when I moved to town. So it's good to know it was heralded somehow. Right, people were like, hey, this person's here. Very cool.
So we've accomplished that,
yes,
today.
Yeah. Affirmed my ego just a little bit.
Well, and boys, so one of the things we're going to talk about, and we're going to, when you stick around for the podcast only portion of the Shop with Nola Drinks, we're going to talk a little bit more about your other work. But you recently just put out a piece in on Medium, if I'm not mistaken.
Heated. A publication within Medium.
Right. Yeah. So Heated within Medium. There you go. Talking about the food hall economy, and I just happened to see it and read it. Really well done piece, man. And I'm sure it was a bit of a challenge to do, and very compelling.
Thank you. Yeah, it was a good bit of work, just trying to make sure that I was getting the story straight, trying to get a lot of different sources that did not necessarily want to be on the record. So.
Right. Yeah. Fair enough. And you did your due journalistic diligence clearly on the piece. Well, let's talk a little bit about this, because we're here in New Orleans. We've seen an explosion of food halls here. Maybe we should start the conversation by telling people, and if you don't mind taking this on, what is a food hall? I mean, and I know it's kind of nebulous, yeah. But.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the first things I had to kind of address in the piece, because it remains a murky and undefined thing, but it's kind of I see it as this update on the food court, which is familiar to most people, but it is much more, I mean, there's an industry report that I quoted that I'm not going to remember the words, but basically they talked about, it was like about authenticity and experience and these sort of buzzwordy things, but generally it's sort of a often cavernous one-room space where there are a number of food stalls, and usually those stalls are sort of either one of a kind or small chains, and so you're getting this experience of it's like a chef-driven cuisine, I'm saying with air quotes on my fingers, you know, that this kind of gourmet experiential thing.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think and if I'm not mistaken too, and let me digress slightly, because it made me chuckle when you made the comparison to food courts, because I grew up in the 80s. And lately I've been watching Stranger Things. So right. That food court thing, we're not really talking about that. We're talking about more chef-driven, in theory.
In theory, yes.
More chef-driven and kind of startup consideration, I think is probably fair to say in many of these instances.
Yes. I mean, I think the pitch often to part of the concept is that this is supposed to give kind of sous chefs or line cooks who want to build their own reputation. It's a way to come in, open up something small and cheap, kind of build up their reputation, build up their experience. So the it's often, I mean, the numbers vary, but I have been told in many cases it's actually cheaper to start a stall in a food hall than it would be even to do like a food truck.
Than say a food truck because the build out's less expensive and you have some infrastructure there for you.
And then ideally the food hall itself, the management company is going to take on a whole lot of services. They're going to take on plumbing and they'll do the servers. They'll take care of advertising potentially. And so there is this like suite of services that you're buying into that you won't have to take care of yourself as the chef or vendor.
So and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think you use this word in the article if I'm not mistaken. So the idea then, if we want to make an analogy with other aspects of private sector like tech or something, we kind of like an incubator maybe.
Yeah, cost sharing. I mean, so specifically I looked a lot at St. Rock Market, which is a food hall here in New Orleans, and Will Donaldson, who started that, talked like he had done co-working spaces first and saw this similarly as this is a chance to do this cost sharing where all of these different businesses and the management company can kind of together carry the burden of some of these costs that vendors, if people are opening up their own restaurants, they'd have to take care of themselves.
Okay, right. Now, and I'm fairly familiar with St. Rock because I've been in there a handful of times, known people who have worked there. They've opened another place here in New Orleans. I know they've expanded their outlets to different cities.
Yes.
I think Miami, correct? And
Chicago. There's another St. Rock in Miami, which it will not be called St. Rock after the end of the year. And he's got the bigger chain is now called Politan Row, and they've got Chicago, and Houston has just opened, I believe.
Okay, yeah. And we see these popping up all over the country. Right. This is not unique to New Orleans.
Yeah, hundreds and hundreds.
Hundreds and hundreds, right. Now, and I think and do you see this as kind of a tangential question here, Boyce, but I'm very curious because I obviously see the New Orleans landscape more up close than I see other things. It's very common in the restaurant industry here where somebody has a good idea and then all of a sudden we have 10 of them.
Right.
Is that kind of what we're seeing with food halls here
and
elsewhere?
Yeah, I mean, it feels very faddish where I can't remember the first. I mean, I lived in rural Mississippi for years, so it was sort of outside of the typical orbit of these things. And then suddenly there was one in Jackson, Mississippi. And, you know, I'd been to New York. My sister was working and now lives in Chicago. And there was like, she works in a WeWork building, which is a similar sort of, you know, co-working, this tech startup-y stuff. And there's like, this fancy food hall on the bottom of that. So I'd sort of seen them. And then when one came to Jackson, Mississippi, I was like, wow, we're really getting to a stage.
You're on the map now.
Beyond being on the map, it was just like, how far have things come when they're, you know, Jackson's got some great, it's an unheralded food city in many ways, but it just was like a food hall here. They've really sort of, there's a wave of coverage of them and people, you know, consumers are really enthusiastic about them because they really do give you a lot of options as a diner. You can walk in with a group of friends and say like, oh, we want all these different kinds of foods. And the offerings are much more appealing than food courts, at least.
Right. So you can wander in as a patron with a group, like you said, so-and-so can go here and so-and-so can go there or mix and match. And then you're kind of eating in a communal area, right? A shared space area. So I think we painted enough of a picture of what a food hall is if you don't know what it is. Now, I think a lot of the idea, right, is that, as I use the term incubator, I think you use that in your piece, is that it's supposed to mitigate startup costs and allow, like you said, say line cooks or sous chefs or somebody wanting to do something a bit different to get their foot in the industry because brick-and-mortar restaurants, when you start something, even food trucks, are very costly. Getting financing is difficult. One of the things that we've seen happen in the restaurant scene here considerably over the past few years is people coming in undercapitalized and not being able to make it because they only have 3 months worth of nickels in their pocket. Is that a really, I know it's a loaded question, but is that really sort of a reality here? I think that people are maybe misled at times on what the actual startup costs can be.
Yeah, I would say yes and no. I think in St. Rock, I can't remember if there were, there's another food hall that I mentioned, the Galley Group, that has a number of locations throughout the sort of Rust Belt. And there's one chef in particular who was sort of like booted out of a food hall. And he was like, he claimed to have been misled about the cost and that they were three times higher than what he had been told. There are a lot of complaints coming out of St. Rock specifically from chefs and vendors. And that was kind of not what drew me to the story initially, but kind of became the heart of the story as I dug into it. Startup costs were not necessarily the biggest complaint. I think that is a place that food halls generally, or St. Rock specifically, it really does seem to be working for people. It's keeping those costs down. But a lot of people, even with those low startup costs, given the structure and the sort of constraints of a food hall, even had trouble making those back at St. Rock or other food halls. Yeah.
So it the startup costs can be considerable, or being able to make back because you're giving away so much up front maybe defeats the purpose a little bit. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, and also, I mean, the incubator claim, I think that that, again, that's going to vary. Right? So we're in this sort of period now, as we said before, we can't even necessarily, we don't have a clear definition of what a food hall is, and food halls across the country are structured quite variously in the way that vendors actually pay for their space there, right? So some places have just a set lease and say, you pay $10,000 a month for your space, and this is what you get for it. At St. Rock, and it seems to, the sense I got from some industry reports was that the emerging approach is this percentage-based rate where you give a certain percentage, which will vary depending on the management company and how many services they're providing, but that percentage is going to come out of your sort of sales as a stall, and that will go to the management company.
So you're paying, in many of these instances, then you're paying a lease, right? You're paying a flat rental fee typically, and then you're paying a certain percentage of your sales?
That is one. I mean, there is that structure. There's okay. Some places are just flat lease, and that's all there is. There's some that's flat lease plus a percentage. There's some that is a percentage only.
Okay.
And it's actually that percentage only that is seems to be the emerging norm. That's what's worked for the companies that have, the management companies, or the food, they're becoming chains, which I think is ironic in a certain sense. But the right. chains that are most successful seem to be using this percentage-based thing, and which is what is in play. In St. Rock, specifically, It is percentage based. There's just a floor to that. So it's like the ownership, the management company, which now I believe is called Bayou Secret. They've changed their name. I can't remember.
They changed it from Bayou Secret to something
to
else.
Helpful Hound. Yeah.
That's it.
And at a minimum, they're saying vendors need to pay $4,500 a month, which is $150 a day. So no matter what you're making, you need to pay that much. So in some ways, you could say there is a flat lease, but that's not actually a lease. That's just a minimum. And then once they're above whatever that threshold would be, I should be able to do the math,
okay.
but not this quick.
Okay.
Once you break above that, you're paying 30% of your sales to the company.
Oh, okay. So if you hit that threshold, then it just becomes a 30% consideration,
yes.
which is going to be above the threshold.
Yeah. And then there are, right. So now from what I understand, I don't have this absolutely confirmed, but I've been told that they have to pay for paper goods now. There's some sort of these ancillary charges. So some vendors have told me it goes above 30% for them, given some of the sort of surcharges that get thrown on as
okay.
well.
Okay. Gotcha. And I mean, and I think that's a kind of a common co-op model in
yeah.
certain ways, where you hit a certain benchmark and then it's just a percent of sales.
Right.
Okay. Well, and I think here, and we're going to take a break here in a couple of minutes, boys, and we'll come back to the conversation. With the case of St. Rock Market, this is a little bit different in that the city owns the building, and the city of New Orleans paid to restore the building and
yes.
actually owns the naming rights, correct?
Yes.
To the,
yeah.
the name of St. Rock
yeah,
Market.
Yeah, St. Rock Market is the name. It's been on there in this sort of beautiful script since 1964 through various iterations of the previous. So this was an old public market, which I think was part of the appeal of putting a food hall in that space, was building on that sort of beloved identity of this public space.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, let's do this, man. We'll continue here for another minute and we'll take a break. So the rent was a bit cheaper than for Donaldson and Bayou Secret, or what they're called now. Because the city was looking to incentivize somebody
yeah.
to come in and operate the space.
That's one of the more shocking facts when you like dig into this is initially Bayou Secret, the management company, was paying $3,500 a month for this entire space, when then each vendor was paying that management company $4,500 a month for their, you know, potentially 10 by 10 square foot. I don't know the precise size, but their tiny stall would be $4,500 a month, while the building itself was $3,500 a month. And that's gone up a little bit. It's going to keep going up throughout the 10-year lease, but maxes out at $6,000 a month. So it was, yeah, I think seeing that discrepancy between what the food hall itself was paying for rent versus what the vendors were paying for rent in this public-private partnership that was intended to, you know, bring fresh foods to a neighborhood that needed them, that was supposed to stimulate, you know, new businesses, I think that was a troubling thing to see.
Yeah, and I want to talk about the grocery portion of this and the fresh food thing, because I think that's important as well. But, I mean, just back a napkin calculation, because I'm not good at math either, but we're talking about, at least even initially, if people are just paying their base amount with the number of vendors in there, that's at least $40,000 plus.
Yeah, nearly $50,000 a month from the vendor. Yeah.
After rent. I mean, so.
Yeah, and likely much, much higher than that. Yeah, like the successful vendors were paying $7,000, $8,000. I have $7,000 as a figure I specifically heard, I would imagine. I think there's one in Miami that's
okay.
paying much more than that. So, yeah, like they. $50,000 at a minimum, but likely much more than that.
Okay, and right. And so
yeah.
with the infrastructure that they're paying for, say, bussers and plates and
right.
dishwashing services, right? And then not to mention the fact that they own the bar. But we'll talk
yes.
about that in a second as well. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. We're chatting with Boyce Uphold. Come on back. All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Thanks for listening in this week, my friends. I do appreciate it, as always. We're chatting with Boyce Upholt. We're talking about a food hall economy, and Boyce, if I recall, after we took the break, or before we took the break, we were talking about the St. Rock Market, and part of the idea, the city owns the building. They were looking for a tenant to come in and operate, and one of the ideas was that there would be fresh, affordable food. And this was something I was particularly excited about, like the idea of being produce and things like that available, almost like a farmer's market consideration, not just food vendors.
Yeah, that's a requirement in the lease the owner management company has with the city, is that they provide those fresh foods.
Now, I do know, and I'll this is not coming from your piece, this is coming from my own experience. When I first went in there, when they first opened, that didn't seem to be met at all, because there was when they first opened, there was a very small fresh produce display when you first walked in the front door on one side or the other. I can't recollect which. And it was a really small amount of, again, fresh produce. And then there was that was it.
Yeah, my understanding is that persisted for 2 years. They do now. I mean, like, I live near the market. I drive by sometimes, and they still have a farmer's market a few afternoons a week. And the other thing, as I was reporting the story, I was in the food hall one day and was kind of looking around and realized in the seafood, there's a seafood vendor that, you know, does oysters and sandwiches and things like that. And I realized they still do have a few, they had a few fillets on ice where you could buy them priced by the pound. And I was like, huh, at this point I'd seen the lease and I saw in the lease that it required that they were selling fresh foods. And I was like, how are they pulling this off? And again, I don't know that that is why that is there, but it felt very much sort of to me as this sort of nominal fulfillment of, right. The stated goal initially of having, you know, restoring this building was to serve a community that did not have grocery options. And there had been surveys of what they wanted and this, and yeah, so in the pitch, the city, Donaldson's company had promised to provide those things.
And this is important. Thank you for bringing that up, because for listeners who aren't familiar, if they're outside the area or not familiar with what we're talking about, St. Rock area is off of St. Claude, and it's, you know, traditionally an African-American neighborhood, lower economic neighborhood compared to other parts of the city. So as you said, the grocery options there were limited, and this was supposed to be an idea of kind of fitting with some of the urban farming and other initiatives that were going on around the city and in the area to provide affordable fresh food. That was one of the, and this was very public, one of the complaints about the place when it first opened was the lack thereof.
Yeah, absolutely. There's just a general sense that the, rather than doing that, this was essentially a gentrification project, that it was going to be selling expensive food that was going to appeal to people like me, middle-class white people that had the money to spend on that, going to drive up home prices and sort of change the neighborhood.
And I think we've seen, I mean, and let's be fair too, because it's not fair to pin all of that on the St. Rock Market. That neighborhood was going that way before that happened.
Yes. As a new arrival, my understanding is that is what is already happening, and I am contributing to it continuing happening in that I bought a house a mile from there. In a block that for the moment remains majority African American. Yeah.
Right. Now, one of the things I mentioned to you before we went to the break, and this was, and people probably know this, or many of you out there listening know this because you work in the industry and things like that, that when we talk about cost centers in restaurants and cost centers in food operations, one of the more profitable cost centers that anybody has is alcohol, because your margin is bigger, and really beverages in general, but alcohol in particular. And so in the case of St. Rock and the other place that they opened here in town, which the name is eluding me, I apologize. The
Auction House.
Auction House. Thank you. The bar is not operated by an outside vendor as the food stalls are. The company themselves operates the bar as well.
And that is generally, from what I understand, generally standard practice at any food hall. In part, that is...
is that a liquor license thing, perhaps? Or is that a...
Perhaps. I also think that, so Donaldson himself, after the article came out, posted on Facebook and posted some responses to some of my claims in the story, and noted in there that, the margins there are sort of required to subsidize the lowered costs that he is offering to vendors. And I think that, there are a lot of food halls the food halls are still often struggling to figure out how to make the economic model work. And so I think in some cases it is necessary in order to pay for the real estate and things like that, that the food hall operators be able to pull in that cost. But that also hurts the profit potential of the vendors themselves.
Okay, thank you for saying that. And I actually happened to read, I was just looking right before I walked out the door to come meet you to tape the show today. I was looking at your Twitter account and I saw that you shared and good reporting as you did, you shared the response about some of the numbers and specifically that question about ownership of the bar and the money then being put back into defray operating costs and essentially subsidize, the operation. And this is just me speaking, I'm not putting words in your mouth. I'm not sure, given the math that we just talked about, that that's particularly necessary or valid.
But. Yeah, it's hard for me to figure. And what Donaldson shared, again, after I had published, I wasn't really inquiring about his profit margins. I was much more interested in what was working for the chefs, but he was sort of criticizing the story for not asking about or sharing those facts. And so he said in 2018, the St. Rock market had a 6% margin. I have a number of questions about that number. I mean, one thing is that the St. Rock location was engaged in substantial litigation in 2018, so I'm not sure how that affected that number, and that's the only number he provided. He was saying that that is in line with most publicly traded restaurants, but most publicly traded restaurants are large chains, which tend to do better. 6% is, from what I understand, a higher margin than the kind of restaurants that most of the chefs in the food hall itself would be seeking to open if they were opening a more chef-centric, service-centric restaurant.
Without a doubt. And actually, one of the topics that we've done on the show for listeners for a long time knows we haven't done one in a while, but we've done periodic shows talking about the restaurant scene, kind of using New Orleans as a springboard, talking about the spate of closures that we've had over recent years and other things. We've had restaurateurs on who are very candid and honest about their operations, and 6%. Generally, the number that I'm given is more like about 3.5.
3 to 5 is what I've seen as the standard range.
So 6 is pretty high in general there. It's an interesting question. Okay. And so let's talk a little bit about this too. This idea, and I found this really fascinating in your article, and this is something that I hadn't thought about, because part of the idea is that people would come in, say a sous chef comes in or a line cook, and they have a great concept and they open it up. And then, you know, the idea is maybe, or hopefully for many of them, is that they actually move on to do a brick and mortar or you know, grow their business into their own thing. But there, this part I never thought about, there are some trappings that sort of come with that, that if you're there for 6 months, your financial record or track record, I should say, is not particularly long to get financing and loans. And it also might look a little ugly because of the amount of money that you've been paying.
Yes. Yeah. I talked to multiple chefs, a couple different chefs, both at St. Rock and other food halls, that indicated that like a sixth after leaving before a year was out, that became an obstacle for them to get that funding. One chef in particular kind of was paying so much. It was a different food hall with that 30% rate, but he wound up paying so much money that in the business plan, he felt he had to, you know, include his previous financials, and that just looked really ugly. And so that was a particular challenge in that case. Yeah. So there is, I think that the structure is problematic in that way. Sort of at the middle level, it can work really well. If you're not doing well and you're paying that $4,500 a month, that can be really hard. If you're making a lot of money, you'll probably be okay, but you're also just handing over an exorbitant amount of money at that 30% if you're making a lot of money. So it's sort of, it can really hurt vendors at the top and bottom ends.
Right, and I never really considered that, because you see just a place that's popular.
Right.
And you think they're killing it in the food hall. And then in all fairness, we have seen, and we're talking about St. Rock here kind of specifically, several places have come in there and then moved on and opened up their own brick and mortar place.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that was, what I was initially attracted to the story because I was just intrigued by the case of the city of New Orleans suing St. Rock. And I was interested in what is public space and this and that. And as I started talking to chefs, vendors that had been in there, I realized that there was just sort of a lot of dissatisfaction. And so I think, again, that is something that Donaldson presented in his sort of his side of the story. Look at the number of people that come out of this. A lot of people have told me that this was a real opportunity for them, but their success was not necessarily, that was a launch pad, but to be able to be successful within the environment, which was often a sort of a negative, very fractious environment. It required long hours. It isn't a simple story of like, oh, I like had this opportunity. It was lovely and golden. It was sort of like, I had this opportunity. It wasn't great, but I took it. I made it work. And I got out when I could, so that I could be one happier and healthier and like start to make profit, like start to make my own space.
Okay. Got it. Yeah. Okay. And then thank you for clarifying that. Actually, let's do this, boys. Let's take a little break. We're going to come back. We'll talk a little bit more about food hall stuff. And friends, if you're listening here on the radio, I do encourage you to go get the podcast, noldrinks.com. It's on all the podcast platforms, or many of them, I should say, because Boyce is going to stick around. We're going to talk about other things that he does besides exploring the world of food halls in New Orleans and beyond. Friends, come on back. All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for listening into the show, friends. I do appreciate it. As always, chatting with Boyce Upholt, and we're talking about food hall stuff and economy. And a special shout out to our friends here at Two Jags once again for hosting us, 823 Decatur Street. Boyce, we want to get to a couple other things. We've been kind of, we mentioned this once or twice, talking about the lawsuit that's going on with St. Rock. And, we mentioned this, the city owns the building and the city owns the name, right? And this is the underpinnings of this.
And so the city owns the building and the name. And so there became a question of, you know, what can be done with that? And so early on, the Donaldson's company was selling T-shirts and mugs, I believe, with this the city-owned logo, and city officials are kind of like, you can't do that. So, you know, it's clear. We've been clear. You can't do that. Shut that down. And then when they opened up, when he opened up his second location in Miami, he called it the St. Rock Market. And my understanding is that's when the city had enough. And was like, no, this is like, that name is publicly owned city property. You can't just pick that up and profit off of it and start a new business. So they sued. That's actually been settled now for a couple months. My understanding, they're paying some, I think a dollar for every T-shirt they sell. There's some small financial thing, but basically that name in Miami will have to be changed at the end of the year is the big outcome.
And then there's a bit of off the sales of T-shirts and mugs, some of that goes back to the city.
Yeah, there's some small amount of money that has to come back to the city. It felt to me like a very small amount of money. But
given the rent and everything else, that kind of makes
beyond
sense.
Any of that, I was just like just literally the numbers I saw. I was like, oh, those are very small. But that, I mean, that's how settlements work sometimes.
Sure.
Yeah, and even because of that lawsuit, or that lawsuit was filed just as this expansion of the food halls was happening, and that was led Donaldson to use a different name. So the you know, that was the only other St. Rock, and when Chicago opened, it was Politan Row, which is the name being used in Houston. I would imagine that will be the name that Miami takes on, but I don't have any idea of that.
Gotcha. Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah. And one of the things that I'd like to touch on here too, and I know we're going to get to a couple other topics before we close out the radio portion of the show. Part of the idea is that we use this term incubator, and we've mentioned that already. It's supposed to be chef-driven creative food, or that's the way a lot of these halls are being sold.
Right.
And what we're talking about, though, is people have to be open, at least in the case of St. Rock, people have to be open at 9 o'clock, and you have to be ready to serve, or 10 o'clock, whatever it is.
Yeah, and I've heard that that's changed now, but certainly when it began, it was 9 a.m.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah. So, and then serving a pretty simple, consistent menu, because there aren't servers, there aren't people there to explain.
Yeah.
Usually there's one, maybe two people working the food stall. Right. So that kind of changes the dynamic of being able to present a broader array of food, and then just the timeliness factor of it.
Yeah. I mean, that's been a front, again, not just St. Rock, other food halls. There's often this sort of, sometimes an explicit process or promise, sometimes a implied promise of like, oh, we're going to mentor you. You're going to learn your way through business. And in a couple of different cases that I came upon, most of that mentorship came down to just more like when food halls were struggling or stalls were struggling, it was like, well, you got to simplify your menu. And so there's this sense from a lot of chefs of like, I'm doing this because I'm a creative person. I have this vision. I want to produce this stuff. But rather than supporting people in doing that, the coaching they're getting is like, well, just wind this back, give people simple stuff, give them what they want. You know, someone told me, you know, when you go to a city, sure, you can get good stuff. And I've had really, really great food at food halls, but like by and large, they're not going to be the place you're going to get the best food in town in any city. So if you're traveling, it's like a lot of people these days do go find the food hall because it means like, oh, I can get access to so many different chefs. Mm-hmm. But you're not necessarily going to get the most interesting or groundbreaking or creative stuff because they are having to kind of make it work within this churn and burn sort of.
Okay, so volume and quick kind of turn volume. And, you know, in all fairness, and I think it's an interesting question, and this is speaking to no specific situation, we do know, and I'm well aware of many people that have operated places in New Orleans that have both succeeded and failed, that, you know, you come in with a particular vision and stubbornness.
Yes.
And sometimes that actually doesn't work.
Of course.
Sometimes that idea of maybe you need to change it up this way to make it more accessible. And then you are operating in a particular venue that has a certain set of realities when we talk about food halls.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, I think one of the other food hall management companies I spoke to said that in those terms, the customer's always right. So you have to adjust that way. Yeah, I mean, again, as I dug into this, what made it feel like a story to me and what kind of galls me the most of how things worked in St. Rock was just this disconnect between the way Donaldson and the management company talked about what they were doing and then these stories I was hearing on the ground from people in there. And again, not just about whether or not they could express their creative vision, but just like whether they felt like they were given this great opportunity. And so he in expanding to other locations, he went out and got investment money and talked. The way he's talked about that in podcasts I've listened to or in interviews I've seen is, you know, we're a mission-driven business and we're like looking to give people these opportunities. And he absolutely has given people opportunity that might not have existed because of this difficult economics of restaurants. But sort of to a no one I've talked to that has been inside the food hall has sort of objected to my depiction of this sort of, I'm trying to remember the word I used in the piece, but sort of this imperial way that he came in here and pushed people around. And there's just a lot of tension in that food hall, a lot of turnover. And it makes me uncomfortable that someone can say, like, after having so many people leaving feeling burned, he can go out and fundraise by saying, I'm such a good person and I'm like doing so much. Okay. I'm providing the service for so many people. I mean, that's how capitalism works often, but it just doesn't. It rubs me the wrong way.
Sure, I get it. So I think in what we're talking about is that you're maybe promised a certain set of things or a certain set of circumstances, not necessarily met. And then not necessarily a lot of flexibility then in how the process operates.
Or even I think there's these promises that are unfulfilled, but there's also just this disconnect between the on-the-ground experience and the way the experience is publicly presented. I think that food halls are often seen, and people are excited about them still, in part because of all of these opportunities, but in part there is this feeling to them of like they seem like this modern iteration of public space. They seem like they're somehow this inherently good thing.
Bootstrap and, grassroots.
Yes. Mm-hmm. They do provide a real opportunity. But if they're run in a draconian fashion, it's not all shiny sunniness under the surface.
Sure. So be careful and then look at these. I mean, when we were talking about the idea of you're not paying a flat lease. You're paying a percentage of your sales and the stuff that we touched on earlier. If you're looking to open one of these places, be aware and ask a lot of questions and look at this idea of what your actual startup costs are, what your actual operating costs are, and then what you can get out of it over a period of time and have a business plan, right? Yep. About what is your entry and exit strategy, perhaps?
I mean, that was one of my intentions here was to start this conversation because there's so little information out there of like what is the norm? And I still don't know what is the, I'm working off of a lot of industry reports that indicate this 30% lease at St. Rock is on the high end. And I don't know, but there are a number of other places that also do that 30% lease, but there's no real conversation of like, what is that the norm? Is that fair? What works for people? And so I was like, let this be the first drop in that conversation.
Sure,
so that people can start,
you
can be thinking critically of like, again, there is an opportunity here. Is it the opportunity that I want or not?
And eyes wide open.
Yeah.
Well, we got about a minute and a half left, boys, before I need to close out the radio portion of the show. Tell us where we can find this piece and all of your other work that we're going to talk about in another shot with Nola Drinks in just a second.
Absolutely. So the best, I'm not that much of a social media person, but I try and keep my website up to date. So it's boiseupholt.com, boiseupholt.com. You'll see any story I publish, I try and get it up there. And so you'll see a link there. This one appeared on Heated, which is a Medium publication published by Mark Bittman.
And you write for The Atlantic occasionally?
For The Atlantic. I've written for The New Republic. I've written for Oxford American. Yeah, so as a freelancer, I write for whoever will pay me to do it. So.
Fair enough. That's what you got to do in that world, right? Sort of maybe loosely related to what we're talking about here today. Boyce is going to stick around, friends, for another shot with Nola Drinks. And we are going to actually talk about some of the other things that he's writing about, probably touch on a little bit of his experiences as, don't take it the wrong way, Boyce, a New Orleans noob.
Yeah.
and some of his journey going on and how you can find some of the other stuff that he is up to these days, get a bit more on his background, that sort of thing. So, friends, if you're listening on the radio, do go get the podcast, NolaDrinks.com. You can find it on your favorite platform, Stitcher, iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, like four others. I can't remember. Whatever. Just go to NolaDrinks.com. It's really easy. And that's what I'll say. And if you're listening on the radio, remember to be kind to one another. Use your turn signal. And until next time, cheers, y'all.
like this. I said, I call your name, but no one came. Now I see you become just like the company you keep. Then he said, all these saints and all these sinners will try.
All right, everybody, up another shot with Noel Drinks. Thanks for sticking around, friends. Brian Diaz here with you, as always. Hope you are enjoying the conversation we're having with Boyce Upholt. And we are about to bounce back over to Two Jags to continue that conversation. And we're going to move on from food hall stuff. I hope you found that very interesting and compelling. I know that I did. We're going to talk about some other stuff with Boyce, stuff that he's up to, writing about cocktails and other things these days. And then after that, I'll be back with my parting shot. Here we go. Yep, another shot with Noel Drinks. Friends, Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening into the show this week. As always, pleasure to chat here with Boyce Upholt, a very fine freelance writer, journalist who has relocated himself to New Orleans in recent times. We talked a lot about food hall stuff. I hope you found that very compelling and interesting. I know that I did. And as I promised, Boyce, as we sit here at Two Jags and have a couple cocktails, we're going to talk about other stuff, man. So you're having an old fashioned. How's it treating you?
It's excellent. I'm drink number two. I'm like, I shouldn't be, it's having heavy conversations about journalism that I try to be precise with after two cocktails. I'm ready to go to the other stuff.
That's exactly why we do this portion of the podcast only stuff and other shot with Noel Drinks, Boys, is that the precision is just out the window,
exactly.
Man. Language, fuck it. You know, it's totally out the window. But you do a lot of really compelling stuff. And what we were talking about here during the break, which is really interesting, you're writing a book on the Mississippi River, and we were talking about different authors that you and I have both read and some of our shared background in these considerations. Can we talk about that one?
Let's start there, man.
Yeah.
You want to talk about the book a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, so there, it's in the proposal form right now where I need to finish that up. Finally, I'm always distracted by paying gigs, but, need to get it all to my agent at some point. But essentially I've lived along the Mississippi River for 10 years now.
And whereabouts besides
I was
here?
In northern Mississippi for a long time in the Mississippi Delta. So a couple of different towns, Indianola, Mississippi, Cleveland, Mississippi for a couple of years. So not quite on the river, but in these sort of like river adjacent counties in a landscape that thousands of years ago would be like these swamps that were fed by the river. And I went out on a canoe trip in 2015 and did just 3 days, two nights, and just like camping on a river island one night. I was like, oh, this is... I've been trying to find the wilderness in Mississippi, and it's very linear and precise, and it's natural because it's all farms, but it's very engineered. And then I went out on the river, and I'm like, this is where this like wild, sinuous landscape. And so I kind of fell in love with that, and just kept writing about it. And now, yeah, working on this book that's about the kind of the past 300 years, all the things we've done to change and shape the river, and looking at sort of now we're kind of accruing many consequences from this like 6 month flood we had this year, to the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, to invasive species. So it's just like looking at what we've done and then giving this kind of tour of the modern landscape and all of that exists. But and which is sort of sounds dark, but also in that same way, there's this beautiful wild place that flows right here, you know, a couple hundred feet from where we're sitting that people don't realize is a wilderness still.
So. Yeah, absolutely. And it's a great term. And the cultures that have developed around it and how they developed around it, it's really interesting. The exchange of information, exchange of knowledge, music, cocktails, food, all kinds of stuff. It's the lifeblood of things. The channelization of the Mississippi River is what it is. That's a topic for another maybe set of shows. We were talking about John McPhee, who's an author that we both admire greatly, in Control of Nature.
Chafalaya in particular is an essay in Control of Nature. I remember one of the first trips I had here, I just sat in Audubon Park and read that. It was sort of like beautiful, but also just like, oh God, where am I? What is this place? So I recommend and do not recommend coming to New Orleans and sitting under a tree and reading Atchafalaya by John McPhee.
Depends on where you sit and read the
book.
What
kind of mental space you want to be in afterwards. Yeah.
If we're, like you said, we're here at Two Jacks Run, so we are about, as Boyce said, about 200 feet or so from the Mississippi River. There are times, just even very recently, when we talk about flood stage and where flood stage is on the Mississippi River. Bring the book out there and actually sit right out here and see how high the river gets versus how low the river gets and what that actually might mean and how we live in a bowl.
Yes.
Here, basically.
Yeah.
So that's cool. So work in progress then on the book? And
yeah, I've been a couple of years, like many years of research since that trip in 2015. Basically, I've been spending a lot of time out there just wandering and exploring. And yeah, I'm excited about it. A lot of my writing's about the river, and so I've built somewhat of a profile around that. And I know there's editors have reached out, being like, "Hey, what's the deal with this book?" And so I just need to get through this proposal and figure out what happens next. So.
This is a complete tangent, but let me ask you this question, because you know, when we talk about writing journalistic pieces, you know, shorter, medium, long form journalistic pieces versus writing a book, those are all very different processes.
Yes. Yeah.
And I've only written articles. I've never written a book. And,
I've never written a book either.
Okay. Yeah. Right on, man. Okay.
trying to, but no, yeah. I mean, it's an interesting, like literally right now, it's every day I'm just kind of like hack a little bit away. I need to get sample chapters, right? So to sell a nonfiction book, generally you get a proposal. So you say kind of...
You pitch the theme, you pitch the topic.
Yeah, you pitch a theme, but then you need an outline that really pretty precisely says, you know, here, chapter by chapter, you know, each chapter needs to be a page or so. So you need to really know what you're doing, and then you need to have a couple of sample chapters to show, look, I've got chops. I can deliver on what I'm saying. And so I'm working on those sample chapters now. But even as I'm doing it, I'm realizing, like, oh, I just know I'm going to, like, write the sample chapter, finish the proposal, we're going to turn it in, fingers crossed, we'll sell it, and then I'll probably toss them out, because even as I'm writing the chapters now, it's like, until I'm like really doing the book, you know, there's a couple I need to get to the headwater. There's like some research I still need to do yet, and it's just like, until I'm really have wrapped my head around the book entirely, in the same way with an article, I get to the end, I'm like, oh, this is the ending, and I got to go back and rejigger everything to make that, to like deliver it to that place. Mm-hmm. I sort of know this stuff I'm doing now is this. And I want it needs to be really, really good. I want it to be, you know, the best publisher possible. But it's also it'll probably get tossed in one way or another. So.
Sure, fair enough. So you got to get to you're gonna go all the way up to Minnesota. Is that the
eventually? I mean, it's not. Okay. Yeah, I'm stubborn about it because I think of especially I've spent all my Mississippi River time has been on the lower Mississippi River, mm-hmm. which is, you know, after all of the Ohio and the Missouri come together, and I think this idea that the like. Minneapolis and St. Paul, that is like the beginnings of the Mississippi River. I'm like, well, but what about Montana and New York, right? It's like what makes this river powerful is the way that it pulls together the water of the entire continent. And so I feel this sort of like there. I've written in drafts of stuff before sort of about my intentional stubbornness to not go see the headwaters of Minnesota because to do so it is sort of submit to this reduced and incomplete notion of what the river is, but eventually I think I will. I've heard it's beautiful. I need to see it at some point.
So yeah, and I've not seen it either, but that raises a good point. It's just one point in a funnel.
Yeah, I mean, I've written it before. It's like there anywhere that rain falls across 1.25 million square miles of the U.S. is the beginning of the Mississippi River because that water will then drain into this river and come down here past this restaurant. So
yeah, right past this restaurant and then out into the Gulf. And you and I were chatting also offline. Off air about Coral Banks National Marine Sanctuary, which is in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico, where I had the great fortune of doing some work in previous lifetimes. And, you know, just the whole watershed, as we talk about, influences these things so greatly. And I don't want to go too far down this road, but when you're actually coming off the Mississippi River and you get into the Gulf, it's just muddy water, and, you know, hence the term. Cliched term, and then you hit this line at about, I'm going to probably get this wrong, about 50 miles out, 40-50 miles out,
sounds about right.
Where the mud stops, and then you actually get Gulf water, which is really mostly water coming in from the Caribbean and that way. And we actually have one of our 8-9 National Marine Sanctuaries sits out there on salt domes that are coral reefs, no islands, no anything like it. And it's all incredibly connected to this entire funnel that we're talking about here.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's complicated connections too, and that's what interests me. Is like I wrote, you know, to come back to food and things like that. I wrote recently about how the oysters in Mississippi were devastated this year because of, you know, this flood we had and the way we yep. have to divert water. And just yesterday, like, people in Mississippi are only starting to learn. New Orleans people will know about the sediment diversions that are planned here, but people in Mississippi are just starting to learn, like, wait, they're going to build a permanent funnel out of the river into the Breton Sound, which means fresh water will be coming every year into the place we're trying to raise oysters, and people are freaking out over there. And it's so kind of like, I had people be like, we need to stop this. I'm like, yeah, but we also need land. Like, we need to build land. It's just, yeah, the calculus of how do we live on this earth and have our society atop a system that is not built for it.
Yes, for us having regular settlements yeah. right in a yeah. specific area. Yeah, the it's been an unprecedented amount of openings of the spillways.
Yes.
And yeah. and putting fresh water into Lake Pontchartrain and yeah. other things here, and what that does to local economy and lifestyle and other considerations, let alone land subsidence and stuff that we'll have you back on, boys, because I think, you know, we talk about cultures on the Gulf, and actually I can think of a good show that we're going to do. Sam Perez is a very dear friend, and they are a very talented bartender who grew up on the Gulf Coast and
nice.
Has a very talented bartender, great passion for cocktails, drinks, other things, but they are also very passionate about the culture on the Gulf Coast.
Yeah.
I can speak to this. This will be a good yeah. show. We can do this over cocktails, which is what we do on the Noel Drink Show. And that will allow me to segue here. So you're going to start, you moved to New Orleans, man, and you're kind of picking up the cocktail culture as well.
I am. Yeah. I mean, this is a sort of random, I think I'm tired or not tired, but I don't like to piss people off. And so when I do this more confrontational journalism, like I did about the food halls, it just like exhausts me a little bit in the periods afterwards to like, you know, to rack my conscience of like, did I do everything right? Did I, yeah. And so, that's part of it. And part of it, I've been drinking booze for years of various forms as I've gotten deeper into food writing and gone to nicer and nicer restaurants and as the cocktail revolution has, you know, a friend of mine says like the cocktail revolution is over. It's a cocktail statehood now. And it's just, it's out there. Yeah. But I feel like I'm like a lot of people who, there's a huge gulf between my knowledge and the knowledge of the bartender. And so I'll get to a bar and open up a menu and just be like, what is this thing with the French name or this? Or I had no idea how to navigate that stuff, but it feels like there's all these rules and you don't want to embarrass yourself in front of the person who's like, seems to know so much. And so through all of that, I got to a stage, I was like, no, there's gotta be a way. There's gotta be something out there that like will help someone like me to just understand the basics. And there are some good resources out there, but I just couldn't find the thing I was looking for. And so, my girlfriend and it was like, well, why don't you make it? And so that's, what I'm pursuing now for Heated, the same publication that, published this investigative story about food halls. We're in talks about doing a column about cocktails and just kind of going back to the basics, leading people like me that don't know much through one, like how to make cocktails at home and what are, you know, how to stock a bar that is not absurd and overly expensive, but can get you what you want and impress your friends. But then also how do you go out and go to a bar and not feel at a complete loss and know what you're ordering.
Yeah. Those are all really good things. I think it's interesting here in New Orleans, and you and I were talking about this a bit before, and I think this is the case. I was telling you about the term that another dear friend coined, cocktail hero. And, you know, New Orleans kind of sits on a place in hospitality, and it's not about this sort of idea. Coming from the wine industry, boys, there is this, the idea of the sommelier to me.
Right.
Where it's sort of like the used to be where it was the Latin priest or the Catholic priest giving mass in Latin.
Yes.
And the vernacular is no one knows what the hell the priest is actually saying. Mass is given with the priest back to the congregation, so on and so forth. And this sort of idea of I will lord knowledge over you that only I can know.
Yes.
And you can't, and you will follow my lead. And I think we see that changing in the landscape in many, many places globally, really. It's never really worked here either.
Right.
We're not talking about magic and we're not talking about rocket science. They're the basic, the six families of drinks that we're talking about here. And then stocking your bar, as you said, you know, there's about 15, 20 things you might need in a
exactly.
bar to make any number of quality drinks for your friends, and just know how to make those few drinks. And it's
yeah.
not that hard.
Exactly. Yeah. And I've been thinking a lot. There are like the six families of drinks, and there's like various iterations of that I've seen in different books. And I've been
sure.
thinking more and more just like, I think what I haven't quite seen, I'm thinking in terms of kinds of ingredients almost. It's like understanding the difference between a liqueur and a vermouth, right? And just understanding the function of these different
base
things.
So spirit, juice, right. Modifier.
Right? And it overlaps with the cocktail families, but it goes beyond that of just, realizing what these things do. And I haven't quite done this yet, but it's been fun. I was at Trick Dog in San Francisco and got a great drink and then got them to give me the specs for it. And I was like, never going to buy most of these things. But I was like, I'm going to take this home and be like, well, think about what are like some common household things I can do and see if I can like make something that I like that has the same. I don't remember the drink, but it had some spice character to it, like jalapeno or something like that. And I'm starting to realize I can do this because I know like when I look at this, I see, oh, there's a float of this and there's, a dash of bitters. And now that I understand what function each of these different kinds of ingredients play, I can kind of diverge from this recipe entirely, but assemble a drink that still might be balanced and tasty and also will have the influence of this.
You hit the key term, and balance is the key term.
Right.
Right. In anything here. And really 3, 4, 5 ingredients.
Right.
Learn how to make drinks. I know we're kind of getting off the rails here again, but 3, 4, 5 ingredients, and then learn how to make a drink that has balance with some of those basic ingredients. And you're talking about a base spirit, and then you're talking about bitters typically, and then you're talking about a modifier or two.
Yeah.
And then that's it.
Yeah, basically, I talk about, I was just writing a draft of this column the other day, and I was like, you have a base spirit, and I think of it as like 4 kinds of modification. This is a very simplistic term, but for people that really don't understand cocktails, I'm like, you are lengthening, chilling, sweetening, and I call it complicating. Because I'm like, I'm going to include daiquiri as a cocktail, even though it's like technically maybe not.
Daily,
it's like anything, right? It's like you're just giving a new sense of oomph or just like a new inflection to the flavor. And that's, to me... and there's like different things do that in different ways. But until I really started to break down and understand these ingredients, I was just like, oh, this tastes good in a glass, but I don't know what's going on.
It's really not particularly difficult. It's like when you cook wine or anything like that too, where you flavor profiles of say your base spirit changes. So how do you introduce your modifier to complement or counteract said base spirit is important stuff. But it doesn't have to be any more complicated than that.
Exactly.
And I mean, there's a reason why the classic daiquiri is the daiquiri, right? Where sugar, lime juice, rum.
Right.
And a lot of these cocktails are 3 ingredient cocktails. And if you go back, and you probably have seen this through your research, you go back to the, Jerry Thomas's book and some of these things, way back when, these things are just interchanged parts where it's the same 3 ingredient drink where the base spirit changes or the modifier changes. And oftentimes you'll just see something where it says syrup or something along those lines. And people will go, well, what syrup? It doesn't matter. It actually, what mattered is what people could actually get and what was seasonal at the time.
Going back to some of the Jerry Thomas stuff was in a way like relieving to me, because again, I had this sense as an outsider, I had this sense of like, I would go to these speakeasy bars and these bartenders would have so many like various tinctures that were so mysterious to me. And I just felt like I was like, oh, there's like a way to do this drink. And then I go back to these historical recipes. I'm like, no, you're just like, it's so imprecise in a certain sense of like, there's just, and as I talk to people that know this stuff, they're like, yeah, they were like hacking ice off of a block of a chunk that came out of a pond and hacking sugar off of a giant sugar loaf. How precise could it be? Right.
Have been out foraging.
There's value to seeing those recipes, but, I don't know if people have intentionally claimed that sense of like orthodoxy or if that's just something as an outsider, I projected upon it, but it's been a relief to be like, oh, there's not, right? Like even I've got like a stack of 8 books at home, and every time I make a drink, I'm like, let me look at the recipe for a Manhattan. And I look at like 8 books and there's 8 recipes. And so it's like a relief to be like, oh, there's not a right way to do this.
No, it's done to taste. And there are certain rules. And we were talking about this off air too. It's like, you got to know the rules to break them and so on and so forth. But we can get into arguments, and people I know around town will argue about how many dashes of Peychaud's you need to put in a Sazerac.
Right.
Some will argue it's 11. Some will argue it's 13. Okay, we are kind of splitting hairs there a little bit. Ultimately, I think, boys, what it comes down to is it's drink what you fucking like, really.
Exactly, my definition of cocktails become like it's booze in a glass that tastes good.
Right.
Yeah.
Use things as guidelines. Right?
Exactly.
There are reasons why certain food pairing rules work because they're borne out over history and trial and error, and your mouth burns when you eat hot food and, drink certain bits of wine and stuff like that, but it's just drink what you like.
Right. Enjoy your preferences and tastes, and don't let anyone tell you that they're not suitable or classy enough.
Absolutely. Know? Absolutely. Hey, you're in New Orleans, man. Yeah. That you're in the right place to
nothing
do all this
is classy
research.
Enough. So
fair enough, man. And it's all just the way it's supposed to be. One more time, boys, tell people where they can find you, your work, and all that good
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, the best spot is my website. It's boyceupholt.com, BoyceUpholt.com.
Excellent. Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah, had a great time.
Thank awesome. You. Friends, we're going to take a brief musical interlude, and I'll be back with my parting shot. All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for listening into the show, friends, this week. I do appreciate it. As always, quick programming note for you. Next week's show, or possibly the show the week after, because we might slot something in before that, I'll let you know, kind of some things unfolding that I can't quite mention now, but maybe so. It's not that exciting. I just haven't, you know, nailed it all down, so I can't really tell you if it's going to happen or not. But something that we are certainly going to do, again, whether it's next week or the week after, we will be chatting with celebrity chef Elizabeth Faulkner. You know her from various TV programs, cooking competitions, these sorts of things, but also a very talented person and a very passionate advocate for reducing waste in restaurants and reducing food waste in general, such as in your homes and places like that. Very interesting conversation, so be on the lookout for that. I am looking forward to sharing that one with you, friends. This is our parting shot. Very interesting conversation there with Boyce Upholt in the featured part of our interview, or the main part of our interview, talking about the economy of food halls. Certainly, we have seen a proliferation of said establishments in New Orleans and beyond. It's going to be very interesting to see which economic model wins out. You know, we talked about how some of the financial and lease terms are established. You know, is it a flat fee, like a lease, straight just paying rent? Or is there a sharing of sales, a combination of the two? You know, and these various sort of co-op models that we see in other stuff, you know, other, you know, like farmers markets and other things. It'll be very interesting to sort of see exactly if, and even if a particular model wins out. I think one of the points that you got as we sort of focused on the St. Rock market here in New Orleans as an example of sort of maybe the good, the bad, and the ugly is probably fair to say. You know, certainly businesses have the right to make money. But it's troubling to me is that in the case of St. Rock, it appears that really, in many ways, one could argue that the city and therefore really us taxpayers here are subsidizing the costs of the market in a lot of ways, very favorable lease terms, and they're making a lot of money. Now, okay, in all fairness, that's doing business, that's making money. If you're savvy enough to negotiate a lease that way and have that kind of margin and so on and so forth, so there you go. And certainly, after the city invested all that money and they wanted to invest money in that iconic building, they needed a tenant. And certainly, some good things have happened there. You know, some people have moved on to establish brick and mortars. It was interesting to talk to Boyce because I think some of those ones that maybe I perceived as a success story were really more a matter of necessity, meaning getting out of the market. But some of that is a little bit hearsay, I suppose, or just from in the eye of the beholder. We'll put it that way. Of course, I stand by Boyce's reporting. I think he did a very good job. He's a very upstanding journalist. Certainly also, there are local jobs that were created. A lot of people from the neighborhood are working in some of the infrastructure, you know, some of the busing stuff and things like that that are going on there, and working in some of the food stalls and things like that, helping out. So there are job opportunities, and there are certainly opportunities for chefs, for example, sous chefs, line cooks, we talked about this too, open a place that they maybe would not normally be able to do if they were trying to find financing and open a traditional brick and mortar, or even, as we noted, building out a food truck. Certainly opportunities for local bartenders, several of whom I've known that have worked there in the bar that the venue itself operates. But one of the troubling things to me, and something that I had noticed since day one, I was very excited about the idea that there would be fresh and affordable produce sold in a true sort of, you know, I got the impression, and this is just from the outside, so, you know, maybe we were all kind of misled this way. Some of what I think Boyce was getting at in certain ways of business has been conducted there at St. Rock Market. But I was certainly under the impression, I can only speak for myself, that there would be sort of a farmer's market kind of consideration going on there. And I was very, very excited about that. And really from damn near day one, because I was in there pretty early after they opened, it was a fairly small produce stand that basically dwindled down to nothing, disappeared. And as Boy said, one of his last times in there, I haven't been in there in a while, it was just a little bit of fish that was there. And, you know, we do know that the money was certainly there for this particular business to expand to another hall in New Orleans, and then also establish at least two other venues in other cities. So there's some money there, and I'll get to where I'm going with this here. But, you know, so, and we do know that, that rent escalates each year. We talked about that during the interview for the tenant, Donaldson. You know, that is the case. But in my mind, when these sort of agreements and considerations for the advantageous terms were not met, meaning the produce stuff that we're talking about here, this is what I'm focusing on in particular at this moment, then the rent and other considerations, I think, for the tenant probably should need to be reconsidered. Right? Part of the promise to the neighborhood, part of the promise to the city was that this was going to be a key component of the St. Rock market, and that certainly did not happen. Doesn't take investigative journalism to see that. You can just walk into the place and see that that didn't happen. Now, if the city didn't have the language in the lease to make sure that the tenant, upheld their end of the deal, then that's really bad planning on their part. And I hope that that's not the case. But I do kind of want to know why that the fresh produce and affordable produce consideration, which was meant to be a benefit for the neighborhood, was not met. There's a question in there in my mind still that needs to be answered. And then why then are the terms still as they are? Why is the relationship still as it is? I don't have all the answers. Haven't read the lease, any contract stuff. So how this all went down, again, if the city didn't cover their butt for this one, then that's a big problem. But it is a question that I'd like to see answered. We talked about gentrification of the neighborhood and other things, not going to touch on that here. I think one of the things that we also touched on, though, at the end of the last segment that's important, and we've talked about this from different angles on the show before, that there's a lot of naivety in the restaurant industry on the part of those that are starting restaurants and food vendors. Okay, I think sometimes the truth is that creative people are not always the best business people. Those that are very successful often are both creative and good business people, or smart enough to put good business people around them. Now, I'm always a big fan of the handshake deal. When I used to broker wine grapes in California, 95% of the contracts that we did were handshake deals. And in the wine industry out there, that's the way a lot of things work. So, and I fortunately really never got burned in any way by virtue of that. But I think that we know in this day and age, you do have to protect yourself. Was talking with a friend of mine who has been on working in the service industry for decades here in New Orleans, talking about a local business person who owns a lot of buildings in New Orleans, and all these people will be unnamed just because of trying to protect identities, and that's also not what we're talking about here. But talking about if you enter a contract with this person, the person will honor what's worded specifically in the contract. If there are any gray areas in the contract or things are left out of the contract, even if you are led to believe that there's good faith there, you will get screwed over by this person. It's an unfortunate reality of our world. And when we work in creative spaces, the arts world, the music world, the culinary world, lots of times people don't want to address those things. They're not fun. It's not what you want to do. You want to be an artist. You want to be creative and that sort of thing. But the unfortunate reality is you actually need to protect your ass through these situations. Make sure that you have contracts. Make sure that you have leases. Make sure that they're reviewed properly. Make sure, as I just said, there are no gray areas. When you're opening a business, a brick and mortar, a food truck, or even maybe going into one of these food halls, make sure that your financing is lined up to do that. Make sure you know what your startup costs are. Make sure you know what your operating costs are going to be. Make sure that you have proper financing when the situation requires it anyway, that you have proper financing to operate at a loss for an extended period of time, right? Sort of that classic business school model with a lot of businesses. It's, you know, if you put in a business plan or you tell somebody you're going to make a profit in the first 3 years, they look at you like you're crazy. Now, in the restaurant world, okay, maybe it's a little bit shorter, but so many people in recent years, and again, we've covered this very well on this show over the past couple of years, have come into the city, tried to open a restaurant. I know this has gone on in other places, and did not have financing beyond 60, 90 days. It's unfair to hire people under those considerations because you can't afford to pay them. You're going to have to shutter very, very quickly. And it's just not realistic to expect that you are just going to light the world on fire in the first 60 or 90 days that you open a restaurant. Have the financing to survive. Know your costs. Have a business plan. Also, for example, as we said in the last bit of the main portion of the interview, have an exit strategy. If you're going into a place like a food vendor set up, like a stall in a food hall, have a plan. How long are you going to be there? What kind of numbers do you need to realize to make that happen? And then how the hell do you get the hell out? What does that lead to as far as getting financing to open up a brick and mortar or open up a food truck? Have your next step planned out. Know what that involves, at least to a degree. and have a plan in place to address that. Also, of course, be ready to adapt. Things change. But the more planning that you do and the looking ahead to consider different contingencies that may occur and to have numbers, plans in place, processes in place, you are better prepared to adapt to the changing landscape and stand a far better chance of being successful. Friends, that's really just kind of business school 101 stuff. And that's what you need to do in any business, including in a restaurant or at a food stall in a food hall. Friends, that's our parting shot. Here's to you.